Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Thursday morning. 9:13 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. I'm known as America's guest host, and I'm here this week. Alan Chartok is on the panel today. Judy Patrick, of course, the VP of Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany. Robert Griffin is here, and communications consultant Joe Bonilla also here. This is what they call an all-star panel. And I know Joe Bonilla loves to hear that.
Ooh,
The email address is panel@wamc.org. If you would like to write us a short missive, keep your letters brief, to the point, on topic, no links.
Read them a couple of times to make sure you haven't messed up.
This is a good point. This is a good point. And I've heard Joe say this before. The sarcasm, it doesn't always translate to the written word. So unless you're very good at it, just keep them straightforward and one a day per person. Now you've heard the rules. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Did anybody watch the Duke-UNC game last night?
I saw the clips from last night, and let me tell you it was Zion Williamson right there.
Wow. Have you ever seen – okay, we usually don't do sports on this show because many of the NPR listeners would say, well, how dare you do anything about sports on this program?
So are we talking basketball now?
The basketball.
Well, I only want to say one thing. I love you, Ray. I really do.
Here's the thing, though. This is a very interesting story in that 33 seconds into the game, Duke star player, Zion Williamson, a mountain of a human being, and – on the Knicks' radar, the Knicks stink right now, and the Knicks may get that first pick, and he'll be the first pick if his knee isn't blown out, which it may be, because his sneaker exploded.
He was going for the play, and it literally just slipped apart. The top of the shoe separated from the other part. It was
nobody
never
had
seen it before.
Nobody
seen
had,
like
had seen anything like it.
Nike says they're looking into it.
Yeah, well, this may hurt Nike in the bottom line.
Well, they have a 15-year deal with Duke right now, and they're in year four for this right now.
Okay, Ray, I have a very important question. Who won the game?
Oh, UNC clubbed them.
Yep.
Once he wasn't there.
Which was 33 seconds into the game. It may well have been a different outcome had Zion Williamson been in the game. But I think the bigger story is that the sneaker exploded basically when he planted his foot and he got a terrible knee injury, which we don't even know the extent
of. So is UNC supposed to be the better one to begin with?
No, Duke is number one.
Oh, I see.
And UNC's, I think, was number eight before yesterday.
Well, thanks for explaining all that.
All right, but that's enough of that. There was breaking news this morning. Chicago police say Empire actor Jussie Smollett has turned himself in to face a charge of making a false report when he said he was attacked in downtown Chicago by two men who hurled racist and anti-gay slurs and looped a rope around his neck. Chicago police spokesman told the AP that Smollett turned himself in early today at Central Booking and has been arrested. There is a press conference, I believe, coming up this hour in Chicago about that. Now, you know, I must confess, I have my mind on other things when I'm in the newsroom and the show is on. So I don't know if you guys covered this story last week, but I would say probably you guys were hesitant to cover this because
I think we may have mentioned
the details changed all the time.
I think we may have mentioned it. Let me just say that we have a president of the United States who is now in full frontal attack on the press, and the history of the press in this country is at stake. The Smollett story, interesting, important, guy says something that may not have happened, you know, but it is not the president of the United States going head-to-head with A.J. Sulzberger talking about, you know, the press is the enemy of the people, and then we see some guy getting arrested with all the guns and following the president's dicta. Right down the line, you know, the Smollett story is important, but it is not nearly as important as what the despicable president of the United States is trying to do to the history, to the quality of a free press in the United States.
So Alan has been on this soapbox since we recorded the Media Project earlier today,
it's
the same soapbox.
Hard to believe.
If you want to hear more of that, Sunday at 6, Monday at 3 on the Media Project.
Good.
But to get back to
when it's on.
So to get back to the Smollett case. This was very important for social media perspective because when this story broke on social media, on Twitter, I think it was a Saturday, you saw the piling on of comments about people, you know, denouncing this young man. And it just, it's a cautionary tale for all of us who retweet, who comment, to make sure you know what actually is going on before you jump on the bandwagon.
What could have this guy been possibly thinking? look at what he's done. He's done incalculable harm to the people that
we don't know his story. We don't know
the full story.
We still don't know. In other words, he has been charged, but do we know in fact that the charges are true? I mean, we just don't know yet.
I hear you, Ray, and as always, you're as sagacious and
don't rush to judgment. That's the bottom line here.
Vet your information first.
Well, it's the presumed innocence, and if we're going to follow the code of law, then we've got to pay homage to the presumed innocence.
Yeah.
No matter how bad it looks.
Well, so, the other part of it too is that for social media, unfortunately, is shoot first, ask questions later. And this is another case of us having to actually vet information before it's retweeted or reposted or anything like that.
And it shows the danger in this rapid fire news and rumor environment of politicians and other people of stature making comments on things before the facts are clear. I think Kamala Harris mentioned it and others. I think Donald Trump mentioned it as well, saying what a terrible thing it was as soon as the news broke. Again, maybe society learns a lesson. Don't quite rush to hit that send button.
Well, I don't think social media is going to learn a lesson for a long time.
No, I mean, when we advise our clients, especially if they're, you know, in public life and they're political figures, you know, basically wait until the dust settles a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, don't rush to judgment just yet, especially if there's controversy with the issue.
And yet, Joe, if you get out front on something like this, when you're advising your client, I'm sure they're thinking, hey, I may be one of 1,000 later on, but
right.
I'm one of one right now.
Well, it's high risk, high reward. That's the issue.
Yes, it is.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. If you would like to join us today, it is the Roundtable Panel with Judy Patrick, Robert Griffin, Joe Bonilla, and Alan Shartok. A Coast Guard lieutenant who was arrested last week is a domestic terrorist who drafted an email discussing biological attacks and had what appeared to be a hit list that included prominent Democrats and media figures, prosecutors said in court papers. Christopher Paul Hansen, due to appear in court today in federal court in Maryland after his arrest on gun and drug offenses, but prosecutors say those charges are the proverbial tip of the iceberg. The court paper said this defendant is a domestic terrorist bent on committing acts dangerous to human life that are intended to affect governmental conduct. Robert Griffin, you may have some insight into this. Kind of a big deal.
So this is a terrifying case. If you really think about it, you've got a lone wolf actor who has the training, the means, and the access to actually carry out a substantive attack. Some of the reports that I've seen also talked about his desire to acquire weapons of mass destruction. There's talks about anthrax and other diseases. This case raises some pretty significant questions in my mind about the vetting of folks and access to security clearances, access to some of the governmental records. This is something that I think we need to go back as a government and look at really closely. How was he able to maintain a security clearance given a history of these writings? What systems do we have in place in order to pick up the characteristics of this? This could have been an absolutely catastrophic situation.
So in your line of work, you deal
with— Remind everybody, Ray, what Mr. Griffin does.
Thanks, Alan. Robert Griffin is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany. In your line of work, you must deal with some of these vetting issues. This guy allegedly sent himself a draft letter that he had written to a neo-Nazi leader in September of 2017 and has identified himself as a white nationalist for over 30 years, advocating focused violence in order to establish a white homeland. 30 years is a long time. How did this slip through the cracks?
I think that's a great question. And from my time before the university in Homeland Security, I can tell you that the vetting process is relatively strict. I jokingly refer to myself as a professional paranoid. you're consistently looking for patterns like this, and we've got to find out not only what happened with the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard clearance process, but all the way back to the Marines and time in the National Guard and military. There's a history here that crosses over multiple branches of the military that are going to have to get looked at. The other thing, too, and I'm sure the Coast Guard right now and their investigative teams and the FBI are crawling through the Coast Guard records to see who else he has had access to. Mm.
There are a lot of people out there, you know. NPR, I believe it was NPR, it was either NPR or The Beeb yesterday that did a very good story about the Bund and Madison Square Garden and how 20,000, right before the war broke out, 20,000 Nazis were in that garden. Now, allegedly, they all sort of disappeared after the war, but I guarantee you they didn't.
No, and Alan, I'm not trying to throw red meat to you, but when you think
you
about
can
the
only
comments
throw grass
after
clippings
after,
at him.
After Charlottesville, this idea that there are good people on both sides, you know, really what we've started
the president
what,
said,
that
yeah.
the president said is that we were empowering people like him to come forward and act out because they believe that there is now legitimacy at the highest levels of government. And you know, that's why those comments to me were so repugnant, because it gave legitimacy to something that this country should not give legitimacy to.
Not only there, but as Judy and I have been fooling around with on the media project, by saying it's open warfare against the press in this country and giving people the ability to do that. And in fact, this character was going after reporters and editors.
Yep, and if you see that and you start to tie it back to the Trump rallies where you see the attacks on reporters at those rallies, you start to see a pattern here. And the scary thing, going back to the earlier comments about the Smollett situation, is that it creates this stain on society, this idea that you can't trust anything.
Sure.
And you know, you start to see these pieces, and I think for the next president, during the next election cycle, one of the things we're going to have to look at is who is going to be able to help start to erase some of this and turn the country back towards a course that isn't so dark.
Very tough, because if you look at these, and I've said it on every program and I say it again, if you look at the numbers, the polling numbers, some way in excess of 90% of registered Republicans are fiercely for Trump.
Yeah. Now, supporters of the president are going to say this is maybe an unstable man, a lone wolf. This is not unusual. You know, we need to, you know, temper our concern. My big worry when I read the stories today was prosecutors are saying this is the tip of the iceberg. My God, he's talking about eliminating everyone on Earth, and that's the tip of the iceberg?
Right, right.
They found 15 firearms, including several rifles, 1,000 rounds of ammo inside his basement in Silver Springs, Maryland. Also, a container with more than 30 bottles that were labeled as human growth hormone, paper said. So we'll find out more about this. Robert Griffin, is it possible that this guy was, I mean, I, the first thing I saw when it said, oh, God, for 30 years he's advocated this, could he be under deep, deep cover? I mean, could these charges go away?
No, I don't believe so at all. I think the charges are going to stick, and in that.
So he's not in any way a government asset that is just there to root out the real bad guys.
I not having any you know insight into the case other than what I've been reading, I would say no. But you know, this is now very, very public. The arrest was made by the FBI in the parking lot of the Coast Guard headquarters in D.C. They must have thought that there was a trigger point for doing this. No, they're going to be this will go to court. This will be federal charges. Again, presumed innocence, but if convicted of these charges, he goes away for the rest of his life.
Well, not to add to that, Ray, it's interesting because the news about this only broke when a reporter was combing through all federal court documents. It's not like they issued a press release.
You make a point.
And right. They did arrest him last Friday, and there was no press release last Friday. So kudos to the reporter who was going through federal court documents, which are not fun to go through. But there are people like that do that.
But this is another example of like the normalization of this abhorrent behavior. But I guess the question I have for you as well is, I assume the military clearance and civilian clearance are far different processes.
Well, they come together so that they have different investigative branches looking at it, but the security clearance process is basically similar.
Okay. But what was interesting was the sort of rush to who found him between the Coast Guard and the FBI. The Coast Guard was real out front about this and said, we found him, we got it, it was us, and we were assisted by these other people. So they must be quite embarrassed by this.
Oh, incredibly embarrassed. I would imagine that this has gone up not only to the commandant level, but up to the secretary level. And the idea that it was actually discovered by the Coast Guard and then reported to the FBI is in part how the agency protects itself from questions of its own competence.
Mm-hmm. He had been so brazen as to use his work computer for some of his searches on Google.
And so, how did that get through the company firewall at the Coast Guard? How did that happen?
Maybe it didn't. Maybe that's what finally happened.
Some of it, I mean, and I think you're onto some of it, is that sometimes things are allowed through because it dings in other places in Homeland Security. So you think, okay, I can go surf the web for bad things, including things like porn, and you think you're getting away with it. In reality, what's happening is that there's a case being built. Without getting too much into the tradecraft of how they do it, you may get away with it for a short period of time, but the systems are actually relatively good about picking things up.
Robert Griffin, you described yourself as a professional paranoid, and we have about a minute here before our news break. How many of these people in relatively high levels of security are there out there that we don't know about?
Well, I don't know. If we knew about them, then we would.
We'll make a guess.
How paranoid should we be?
Well, I think the systems have been in place in order to pick these folks up. Okay, that
was picked up.
That right. So there are checks and balances, and again, this checks and balance becomes really important. But also, when you start to think about government services, when you start to think about, well, you know, we don't need folks in Office of Personnel Management. You do, because that's an independent branch that's looking over how investigations are occurring.
We have to take a quick break here. It's the roundtable panel: Judy Patrick, Robert Griffin, Joe Bonilla, and Alan Shartok. And you, if you want to write us an email. Briefly, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will take a quick break and be back after news. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. Oh, lovely Roy Eldridge music today there. Engineer Mike Bowen. Before there was Dizzy Gillespie, there was Roy Eldridge.
And before Roy Eldridge, there was Mike Bowen.
No, Mike Bowen. No, that's our engineer.
I got it. Okay. I understand it.
It's the Roundtable, and it's the Roundtable panel. That's Alan Shartok, Irascible Alan. Judy Patrick is here. Robert Griffin is here. And Joe Bonilla. And, of course, you can join the fun by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. And I understand we have some.
We do, Ray. And thanks for bringing me in on this. Michael says of the media, good morning, Alan, spelled wrong. The media is certainly under attack. Have you seen the $250 million lawsuit filed by the lawyers of Nicholas Sandman against the Washington Post? P.S. I knew the Jesse Smollett case was a hoax as soon as the actor said that the attackers were wearing Make America Great hats again.
Yes, I did see the lawsuit. So it's for $250 million against the Washington Post, and it seems to be much more symbolic. Obviously, the price is symbolic because of that's the amount that Jeff Bezos had purchased it. You know, and certainly that's another issue that, you know, media organizations have to face, is that, you know, people have the unfortunate ability to be sue happy in this situation.
Well, you've got Clarence Thomas sitting on the Supreme Court of the United States writing a concurring opinion along with all of his fellows, but he said, you know, we got to revisit the controlling libel laws in this country because, parentheses, this is what I think he's saying, people like me have been subjected to bad remarks too long now, and now if somebody says something bad about a public figure, they should be allowed to sue like anybody else should.
Well, then, of course, the president amplified this, saying, well, go get him, Nick. You know, it's like that sort of behavior is why we have so many issues with violence against journalists right now.
Okay, shall I read on?
Yes, please.
Thank you. John says of the Smollett case, good morning, panel. Jesse Smollett may be guilty of faking a racist attack, but I think that the media is equally to blame. Between Smollett and the Covington kids and other incidents, the media has jumped on every opportunity to portray we Trump supporters as bad people without doing their homework. This includes NPR. Okay, and it was way too long a letter, so I'm going to stop on that letter.
Man, we are the dog to kick, aren't we? The media is. It's to justify the coverage, I mean, people are interested in this case. It was, if true, it was out there. It was so horrific. People wanted to know about it, and he had the added interest of being a celebrity. He was on a very popular television show
TV
called
show.
Empire. Yeah,
yeah. Still is.
Still is. Worthy of coverage, sure. These kinds of false accusations happen a lot. And the media, the mainstream media, does a good job. What happened here, again, with social media? And you can blame social media, which I do. Twitter is a cesspool.
Yeah.
But
except for Joe Bonilla's tweets. Thanks.
But in many cases, that's where all the damage is done, not in the mainstream press.
Well, it is interesting that people see an opportunity, something like this, to say we Trump supporters, when we know that the state Senate in New York just went Democratic heavily because Trump is so unpopular in New York. So it isn't as if the poor Trump supporters, you know, haven't had their chance in elections in other places, but too bad. Okay, Janice says, domestic terrorist, why are we just hearing about this when it happened last Friday? Has this been swept under the rug by the Department of Justice? And that's from Janice.
But it's not unusual for the Department of Justice to make arrests and to keep things secret for a while. I mean, I believe in open courts and the public has a right to know many things. It is true in this case that they didn't issue a press release. Maybe they were going to once they brought him into court. But the other point, probably Bob would know more, is that they're trying to maybe there were other parts of the investigation they wanted to hold.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm relatively certain that what occurred after the arrest on Friday was that the investigations, and when I say investigations, you think about how carefully you have to go into any facility that this gentleman has been in. So you have to look for booby traps. You have to go really slow. The less of a circus atmosphere you have around the initial steps, the better the investigation is going to be. But they were working really hard. That arrest was just the beginning of an awful lot of collection of evidence that was occurring.
And when you talk about the Justice Department, the single story, it seems to me today, that really rises to the top is that the Mueller investigation is coming close to the end. And we have a new attorney general who promised as much as possible he would get the information out to the people, but 87% of whom in a recent poll said every single word of that investigation ought to be made to the public. So what would you be thinking if you were sitting there and you were he, the new AG, and you knew that you had had a fine reputation up to now, but if you were seen as carrying Trump's water, you know, that would be quite bad. Don't all talk at once.
No, it absolutely would be viewed as bad. First, though, let me put a shout out. Just despite everything that you see in tweets, the FBI is incredibly competent.
Right.
They're extremely thorough. I mean, minuscule. I mean, down to evidence that's at the microscopic level. And they slowly build cases. So this idea of rushing the Mueller investigation really bothers me because it needs to be thorough. Honestly, on there are elements of the report that I don't think should be public, particularly if it gets into elements of tradecraft or about how we're gathering information or intelligence about particularly Russia. So there are some elements of the report that probably do need to be redacted.
And will never be seen. I mean, they'll be in camera.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think there's a no matter what Barr does, he's in a position where part of the people are going to view him as holding back, and that there's a conspiracy to hide the information, and the other are going to be chastising him for releasing any of it.
But don't you think there's a possibility that it is conspiracy, that this president of the United States does not want that information out there?
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. But now, where on the spectrum it is, I think is the hard part to tell. Mm-hmm. But I need to go back to again. I think what folks need to understand is the incredible capacity that this nation has for investigations in the FBI and the real professionalism of that organization, which is taking an unfair beating.
Do you think the report is going to be definitive? We'll say there was collusion or there was not. I mean, I think that is what the American public really wants to know. And if it's too long and too windy, they're just going to take the parts they want to read and believe in and take them and disregard all the others.
Well, when you're putting people in jail, which we are now in the process of doing, and you say things like, individual A was given something by his superior at the top. Who do you think they're talking about? They're talking about Trump, in my mind. I'm sure the last thing Trump wants, and the reason he's attacking the New York Times so vigorously right now and everything else, is he sees it come. He sees the train coming down the track, for sure. Anyway, Norman writes, panel, we know who the real enemy of the people is, not the enemy of the Russian people, not the enemy of the Saudi people. The president of the United States is the enemy of the American people. That's from Norman. Okay, and Virginia says, white supremacists underground. Hi, panel. I don't remember the name of the group, but I recall reading about former white supremacists who said that the Klan and other groups have advocated that their members go underground and assume regular jobs in the military, law enforcement, et cetera, in order to promote their agenda. When I hear reports of cops killing unarmed black men in cases like the Coast Guard employee today, I wonder if these cases are part of a real policy. Sometimes there is really a conspiracy. Virginia. That's all I got, Ray. Sorry.
I mean, certainly that is the case in some situations in some parts of the country. And I think that's where, you know, folks try to take control of, you know, different institutions of civil democracy here. And I think what we need to look to do is obviously that character and fitness of who we hire and who we want in our society.
And the other part of it, Ellen, is I think that if you're going to be in the military or you're going to be in law enforcement, that there should be a higher level of scrutiny over what you do in your private life.
Right.
So we have a real understanding of how unbiased you're going to be in these incredibly powerful and important positions.
So if you think McCabe, for example, McCabe's wife who ran for political office?
Yes.
And so you ask yourself, does an employee of the federal government have the right to say to their partner, you can't do this because it will reflect badly on me? I mean, it's fascinating. I know that my wife is pretty way out front when it comes to her anti-Trump activities. And in the beginning, I was nervous, and then I stopped being nervous. I just said, hey, she's an individual. She has a right to do what she wants.
So I agree with that. But what I think in the McCabe case, he just needs to acknowledge and needs to be on the record that he says that there's this potential conflict. So as long as it's reported and everybody knows so that it's in the open, I think that's okay. You start getting to the point where you start to say your wife or your spouse or your children can't do something or your parents can't do something because of these positions, that's going to have a real chilling effect on how and where people are recruited. But at the same time, I do think that if you're going to be in one of these positions, that we should be able to interrogate your Twitter accounts and your online presence. And if there are things in those that bring to question your ability to perform your function, then you need to be moved out of those positions.
So you are in favor of Strzok being taken out of his role as an investigator in the Russia affair because of the texts he sent with his girlfriend?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, because no matter what he brings to it, it raises question of bias about the investigation. And our investigations need to be absolutely bias-free. I mean, and that's going to be part of the, I think what Mueller has been doing very carefully is that it's just the facts, ma'am, going back to the old saying.
Joe Friday. Right. Right. Let's take a break here. Joe Bonilla is here, Robert Griffin, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and the email address is panel@wamc.org. About halfway through the panel, and we'll take a break. Be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Thursday morning, 9:46. America's guest host, Ray Graff, with you. Alan Shartok, Judy Patrick, Robert Griffin, and Joe Bonilla are on the panel. And the email address is panel@wamc.org. And Alan, I guess we have a few more letters, and then we'll get to the next topic.
I should say, of course, that we've had a lot of letters about your service here, Ray, and how respected you are.
Oh, you got my letters. Oh, good for you.
How respected you are. Okay, so let's see here. Lisa says, good morning, panel. Our current president never tires of berating, inciting violence, and espousing untruths, which lead to the magnificent rise in hate crimes. Coast Guard lunatic is only one such example. Then on the other hand, you have Jussie Smollett pulling the stupid stunt, denying all others who are actual victims to face nothing but scrutiny. I want to invoke the words of our panel. Our very bright panel says he's not been convicted of anything.
That's right.
Try to remember that. A report this morning on MSNBC stated that Joe Biden is wary of getting into the 2020 race because Trump has no empathy or compassion and will attack him and his family personally. I'm just disgusted, says Lisa in Pequog. Well, hey, if you're going to get into a race for president of the United States, you have to have pretty thick skin, I think, don't you? I mean, you can't say, if they're going to attack me, I don't want to be in it. Of course they're going to attack them.
Well, anybody who enters public life, I mean, that's part of that unspoken agreement that you have to be okay with that, especially the higher and higher you go, especially if you're running for president of the United States, you have to be okay with people attacking your character as perhaps as untrue as it might be, but that's part of the unfortunate game.
Guess what? That statement by Biden is going to come back to haunt him.
Right.
They're going to use that to attack him.
Sure.
If he
and
runs.
Attack his family. And Marco says, where's Carver? Oh, I see. That's his last name. Okay. I found, theoretically, if Trump is under Putin's control, as McCabe suggested, and Russia's goal is to sow chaos in order to weaken the United States both domestically and globally, then isn't the mission accomplished?
It's well on its way if it's not completely accomplished. I mean, if you think about our relationship with our key allies and what we've done with NATO and what we've done with Europe and what we're doing in the Pacific right now, our foreign policy is a dumpster fire.
Yeah, the train definitely left the station on that one.
Jamie says, Coast Guard luck. The scariest aspect of this story is that we got lucky this time. The perpetrator was caught after years of preparation by a Google search done at work. The questions raised are, was he working alone, and how many more like this are out there? That is why I talked about the 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden for the Bund rally. They and their descendants are still around.
This is the Roundtable on WAMC, and thank you for your letters at panel@WAMC.org. Judy Patrick is here, Robert Griffin, Joe Bonilla, and Alan Shartok. Tyson Timbs admitted he'd sold drugs. He accepted his sentence without a fight. What he would not quietly accept was the police seizing and keeping his $40,000 Land Rover that he had when he was arrested. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court sided with him unanimously in ruling the Constitution's ban on excessive fines applies to the states as well as the federal government. The decision, in an opinion written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, could help efforts to rein in police seizures of property from criminal suspects. This was a pretty big case.
Oh, yeah, huge. I remember back in the day when I was just a small fry, which I'm just still a small fry. I remember working for Senator Orenstein. I was doing consulting for him. And somebody who was there from law enforcement said, I'll take you to the train, Professor. So he put me in a car, and it was something like a Thunderbird. It was a beautiful car. And I said, where'd you get this? And he said, oh, it's just one of those cars we picked up when we arrested an offender. So this has been going on for a long, long time.
Well, it's certainly, and here in New York State, you have all these different police auctions and you have so many different lots there. But the other part of this is, too, that, I mean, there are incorporated and unincorporated parts of the Constitution. And with the Eighth Amendment, this was one of those unincorporated portions that finally has some definition to it. And certainly for localities and states that look at basically these fines, these seizures as a method of revenue, I mean, it's definitely it lends to the question about, you know, how they're going to budget in the future for this.
So, Joe, when you say unincorporated, what do you mean?
Well, you have to have the definitions for it. So, for example, incorporated provision of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you have things that have been defined by case law.
By law.
Right.
Or statutory.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know, I'm interested to know what impact this will have on those outrageous fees that are attached to every traffic court violation. I mean, people are spending, you know, $500, $100, or up to $1,000. The fine itself isn't much, but it's that court fee that, will drive the bill way sky high. And that's not addressed. But this idea of these seizures of these, you know, luxury cars, often Rolex watches, and then sometimes they auction them. Sometimes they put them back into service and they use them in their undercover work. Has been going on for a long time at the state level.
Now, I've definitely seen it. It's just, you know, going to the police office here at the state office campus in Albany, and you see Lamborghinis, you see Aston Martins there, and it's incredible, like, the amount of cars they have there. So this is game-changing.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand the philosophy behind it in the sense of, you know, you want to show the community that crime doesn't pay, and you're not going to be driving around in your fancy car if you're arrested. I also have a fundamental problem with law enforcement being funded by an eat-what-you-kill philosophy, because just by
eat
the
what
very
you kill, I like
the very nature, you're going to go out and try to get more because that's where your funding's coming from. So it actually will lay bare, I think, a funding issue with law enforcement that's long overdue to be addressed. I also think it's really interesting that, you know, the 9-0 vote is sending a very, very clear message that the Supreme Court is unanimous in the feeling that this applies to state and locals. I also see this not only as a question of seizures, but I think it raises some really interesting questions about takings in general, which is going to influence or should influence what could occur on the border, because in order to build a wall, the federal government is going to have to take an awful lot of land, and that's a seizure.
Eminent domain,
right. Right. So I mean, you start to look at this case law, it's all sort of intertwined in that area. So this is a case that I think could have some interesting implications, not only for law enforcement, but certainly for the border policy.
So isn't eminent domain fairly established in terms of the rights of the state or the federal government to take land?
It's continually reestablished through courts. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the court decisions, the court has leaned more conservatively towards the property owners rather than the right of the government to come in and take land. So, you know, there's the Williamson case and other Supreme Court cases that really have limited our ability. And I look at a 9-0 decision in this as sort of a further repudiation of government's ability to take. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. The email address here is panel@wamc.org. Keep those cards and letters coming, as they say. We'll start this now, and then we'll have to take a break for news. An Alabama woman who joined the Islamic State group in Syria won't be allowed to return to the U.S. with her toddler son because she's not an American citizen, the U.S. said Wednesday. Her lawyer challenging that claim. In a brief statement, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo gave no details as to how the administration made that determination. Ms. Hoda Muthanna is not a U.S. citizen and will not be admitted into the U.S. She does not have any legal basis, no valid U.S. passport, no right to a passport, nor any visa to travel to the United States. Her lawyer said she was born in the U.S., has a valid passport before she joined the Islamic State in 2014. This was another interesting thing that happened yesterday. Who wants first?
Well, you know, she regrets her decision to join or to marry an ISIS fighter in Syria, but now she has come to regret it. She has a child, and she wants to come back home. She's not really clear about why. She says she's willing to pay the penalty for whatever she did. I don't know what crime she would be charged with, but probably the feds could come up with a few. I'm curious about why the government is taking such a strong stand on this and making it such a public case.
The Brits are also doing it at the same time.
Exactly.
I don't know why.
So, I mean, what scares me about this case is there's confusion about her status. She had a U.S. passport. She had a U.S. passport that was renewed. And then all of a sudden she doesn't, and I have a real concern about the idea of an American citizen or someone who has an American passport not being allowed back in the country. If it's a due process question about what she did, then she should be allowed back in, and the due process of the law should be
which
applied.
She says, by the way,
absolutely. Right. So I find that part of the most disturbing piece of this. I mean, that we have all of the issues of ISIS and how horrible they are, and her role of potentially breaking federal law. But still, at its core, my question is, if she is a U.S. citizen, was recognized with a U.S. passport, we just can't start denying access back into the country of our residents because we don't like what they're doing.
Well, how many U.S. citizens who have gone to fight with al-Qaeda or ISIS have ended up in Guantanamo as war, you know, not war criminals, but certainly enemy combatants?
Well, I think, Ray, you're getting to the heart of what the concern is with both our government and with the Brits, is that we have all, you know, as the caliphate has fallen apart, all of their residents that were fighting for ISIS now have nowhere to go, and they're looking to reparate back to where they came from, which means that you have people coming back to your country that have actively supported these efforts, and you start to think about homegrown terrorism, you know, start to think about, you know, the message that's sending. I think that's part of the reason why they were taking such a hard position, and the Brits are taking such a hard position, because there's thousands.
But I think the other part of this case, too, the complication of obviously who her father was a diplomat from Yemen as well.
Correct. Although, if you look at the timeline, he wasn't a diplomat from Yemen when she received her passport. So she actually received her passport after. Just for folks at home, you can't receive if you were born in the country to a diplomat carrying a passport from another country, you don't get American citizenship.
Hmm.
So therefore, she doesn't have American citizenship.
No. You see, this is the problem. She wasn't a diplomat when she was born here. That's how she got her passport.
I get it.
Well, let's take a break. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Robert Griffin, is here. VP of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here. Communications expert Joe Bonilla is here. And Alan Shartok is here. You are also there. We hope you stay there. There's news on the way and then more roundtable. Welcome back to the roundtable on a Thursday morning, 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Alan Shartok is here. Jordy Patrick is here. Robert Griffin and Joe Bonilla, they make up the panel. And you can join us with a quick email, brief email, succinct email to panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Let's see if we can get Alan off of his handheld device and he can read a couple of emails.
I'll do whatever you say.
Focus.
Because
focus.
You're the chief.
All right, focus.
Steven says, return of Alabama resident. Isn't it international law that each individual has a right to citizenship? Please discuss, Steve.
Once you take up arms against the U.S., does that right go away?
Well, the question is, in this case, is she indeed a citizen?
That's
what they're really debating at this point.
That's the crux of it.
I think it's primary. I think if the question of your citizenship is not in question like it is in this situation, and you take up arms against the country, there are sets of laws that are in place. But you come back and you go through an American system of legal process.
Sure. Jill says, on NPR this morning, it was reported that the woman burned her passport soon after joining ISIS. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just telling you what they said.
It was on NPR?
That's what it says here.
So burning your passport doesn't make you a non-American. I hate to say that, but it's being an American and having an access to the country is not based on that single piece of paper. It's an inalienable right that you know. The question is whether she had or not.
Okay. Or your draft card. I remember
right.
That
you can still get drafted if you burn your draft card.
Right. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah. Symbolic gesture.
Right.
Roger says fanatics with guns. How many left-wing fanatics like James Hutchinson, who shot Steve Scalise et al. On June 2017, does the panel believe are lurking out there? Thank you, Roger.
All right, we'll send that one over to Robert Griffin.
So I can't quantify what the number is, but I mean, let me just toss a couple variables at you. Guns are easy to get, and I mean, they're a heck of a lot easier to get in Virginia than they are in New York. You have a culture that's very permissive to the sense of use of violence as a way of dealing with your dislike of people's position, whether it's political or philosophical or religious. And we have become more tolerant in supporting extreme positions that as recently as a few years ago would have been impossible to say in public because you would have been absolutely shamed. So you put all of that into this mix, and you're seeing an environment that is absolutely ripe for these lone wolf and it may even be pack attacks
to come out of the dark
because we have made it so that it's okay for people to take what was unacceptably extreme positions and hate positions, and we've legitimized it.
Robert Griffin, before you were at UAlbany, you were in governmental Homeland Security?
I was with Department of Homeland Security.
So when an investigation like this of the lieutenant in the Coast Guard takes place, it's very in-depth and it takes a long time, right?
Absolutely.
My question is, going back to the Vegas shooting, nobody ever came up with any motive of any kind for this. And the FBI, the state, the local police, what happened there? And why the mystery after all this time?
You know, unfortunately, it's not always a smoking gun. And part of what I think the country has come to expect is that we can wrap up an investigation in 60 minutes and have an absolute answer to who is guilty and what the reason
is. It's been over a year.
But the truth of the matter is you don't know because unless there was a signed confession about why I did it, I mean, there are lots of variables that you could point to. But all the key people who could explain it are dead or gone.
Including the fact that some people are just, I know this is a bad term and I get mail on it, but crazy in the head. I mean, you know, you just don't know that somebody doesn't have an impulse. They say suicide. Suicide, for example, is impulsive. People say, oh, yeah, I think I'll just kill myself right now. Somebody may pick up a gun and say, I'll kill all these people right now, both of which are deeply problematic.
But the Vegas shooting required planning. It required a lot of legwork and research as to angles and everything else and what room to take. So this guy put a lot of thought into that.
Absolutely. But the question is, why?
Yeah, sure.
That is the question.
And what you may find is that there isn't a single overriding reason. It wasn't that he hated country western music or didn't like Vegas. It comes down to there may have just been a whole net of small reasons that added up to this big ball of hate. And in sort of unpacking that becomes really, really difficult because you can't point to a single or even a couple of reasons why it was. There's too much tied up there, and it's all within him and his psyche.
I guess the reason to try to unpack that is so you could predict the next one before it happens. That's got to be almost impossible.
It is impossible. And again, this is, I think, the challenge that law enforcement has, is that not only is it impossible, but you're starting to get into some of our fundamental civil rights about how much do you want law enforcement looking into the life of a private citizen, you know, in order to be proactive in picking up characteristics that might lead you to this. But it's also one of the reasons why programs like See Something, Say Something.
I was about to use those exact terms.
It's really important.
Well, we saw Times Square. An alert citizen saw some smoke coming out of the back of a truck.
Great example. And not only that, it's not tattling to law enforcement when you're raising these issues. You could actually be saving the life of someone that you care about greatly.
Sure.
Anybody?
No, I mean, that's the same thing as you can make it. I mean, the thing is, I mean, for anything like this, you also worry about the unfortunate copycats as well, or those who are inspired by this as well.
Exactly. You know, I was at Tanglewood one night, sitting pretty close to the front, and I noticed there was a bag on the stage right near where the conductor goes. So, you know, you read about See Something, Say Something. So I went up to the lady who was standing up front, and one of the volunteers, and she just walked over and grabbed it and took it away.
Didn't say anything?
No.
You didn't find out?
No. Well, I knew, obviously, if she's carrying it away, that probably was nothing, but they tell you to say something.
I mean, depending on the concert you go to at Tanglewood, I'm sure there are plenty of bags around, but...
You know, people do want to try to figure out why something happens because they're trying to make sense of things. But in the end, almost all these cases, you can't make sense of it. They're senseless.
Yeah,
and just
right.
have to accept that it's senseless.
You know, I probably should have done this before we started the program or just at the beginning.
Sure.
Bernie Sanders. Just say Bernie Sanders.
Bernie
Sanders raised more than $6 million since he announced his 2020 presidential campaign.
Actually, today it's probably $12 million.
Probably something about that number.
Yesterday it was $6 million.
He said Tuesday that nearly 150,000 individuals had contributed to his campaign. Previously, the biggest first-day fundraiser in the race had been Kamala Harris, who raised $1.5 million in the first 24 hours of her campaign. That's pretty huge, right?
Right.
Does he? Does that mean he's the front runner, Alan?
Well, he certainly is a front runner. It certainly isn't Kirsten Gillibrand, that's for sure. But I do believe it's. But I do believe Bernie has an audience who dismiss the pundits, who say, "Well, he's too old. He's this. He's that." They dismiss him. They just give him money, and they say they hold up their hand when the pollster calls him.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if these are the same donors who donated to him last time, or whether or not he's expanded his base at this point. Because I think it's important. He's got to. It's got to be more than just that core that he had last time.
Well, his big problem has been, and it continues to be, I'm sure, until proven otherwise, is with people of color. They did not support his candidacy, and that's why Hillary won. Whether or not a specific group of people now feel, well, maybe we wronged them, is something that will have to be determined.
Well, the other part of it, too, I mean, now with him in the race, and then there'll be others, you know, certainly if Joe Biden gets in here, I mean, there's only so much, you know, Democratic money in terms of low, you know, small donors and high donors as well, and you have such a fractured field. So for Bernie to have $6 million at this point, it's truly incredible. It's truly a feat. But certainly as we look at who else might enter the race, and certainly those fundraising targets and disclosure requirements throughout this year leading up to the primaries early next year, you know, how much can this be sustained? And certainly what is the impact on, you know, state races, certainly for the Senate as well for next year?
You know, Alan mentioned the fact that Bernie has raised this money and isn't necessarily the front runner. My question is there an analogous situation to the Republican primary race last time around, in which the field was so huge, we ended up with a candidate for the presidency who was out of left field that no one expected. Is there a chance that the size of this Democratic field, which is continuing to grow, could lead to somebody who is right now in the weeds, such as Kirsten Gillibrand?
Absolutely, it is possible. I don't think it's possible with Kirsten Gillibrand, by the way. I don't know what the heck she's doing there, but that's my own personal opinion.
Didn't we say that about Trump, though? What's he doing there?
Kirsten Gillibrand is not Trump. Trump.
No. I understand that. But what I'm saying is, she's a person right now, you look at the numbers and you say, well, she's got no shot. What's she doing there? Right. But the field was so big last year with the Republicans, in walked Trump.
Yeah, in walked Trump. So in the weeds right now becomes it's imperative for us to look at, when somebody comes in, who do they steal from? There has to be a board game of this, about this. But who do they steal from? In other words, if Bernie comes in, obviously Elizabeth Warren gets hurt, right? Because it's the same audience, the same group. They adore Elizabeth Warren. They tell you that. But, you know, there's no question you get to vote for one, not two.
Now, during the last time round, who was the big money maker in terms of the Republican candidates? Who walked into those primaries with a ton of money? And did that do them any good?
It was Bush.
I was about to say Bush had a lot of money.
And didn't do him much good at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It is a very large field. I don't want to upset Bernie supporters, but I am still concerned about how he treated the allegations of sexism in his campaign last time. He really has never addressed that appropriately. I mean, there's plenty of time for him to do it yet, but I'm waiting on that one.
When you say appropriately, I mean, I've heard him speak on this. What's appropriately?
He dismissed it. I was busy running a campaign. Well, you know what? If you're, he's going to be busy running a country too, but he still has to make sure that things that happen at a lower level are done well. I mean, just because you're the guy at the top and you're busy doesn't mean you're not responsible for everything that happens in your organization, because you are.
No question.
And that was definitely reflective. I mean, 4 years ago, going back to his Daily News editorial board notes, I mean, that it was not so much of a deep dive. It seemed like he really had no control over his campaign. But going back to, obviously, who else could, you know, create that fieriness in the campaign? I mean, obviously, if Beto gets in the race as well, I mean, he could be that Trump-like character in this mix on the Democratic side.
What do you see Beto's characteristics, political characteristics are? I'm having a hard time figuring that one out.
Well, he's certainly a firebrand.
And he's charismatic.
Right, he's charismatic, but he can also raise money. And you saw, obviously, last year when he ran against Ted Cruz. I mean, the ability for him to raise as much money as he was able to and be able to move the needle as close as he was able to, that's somebody who has momentum to actually galvanize more of the country.
So where would you put him on the political spectrum?
Where would I put him?
Yeah. In other words, let's say Bernie's on the left with Elizabeth Warren. And,
that's a fair statement.
You know, yeah.
What'd you say?
That's a fair statement.
Yeah.
Bernie's on the left.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Right.
Good point.
So, so then where would you put Beto?
I would put him close to Kamala Harris, and certainly almost like that Obama-esque characteristic, where basically he talks a progressive game, but there's certainly much more moderation in terms of his actual policy positions.
So more like Obama.
I would say that.
Yeah. Texas liberal is not a New York or California liberal.
Right.
You know, if you talk about games, it's certainly going to be a political hunger game that goes on. And in my mind, the question is how do you get the nomination so you have to track far enough to the left, but you need to stay close enough so that you can pull the center votes? And I think that's going to be the key.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because I've always felt that Bernie could have won this last election. The reason I think that is because the American people, particularly in particular pockets, were interested in an outsider. So the irony is you had, you know, the potential Bernie voters and the potential Trump voters often were saying one and two. These are the people I'd rather have. So what they didn't want was a middle of the roader at that time.
Yeah, it's an interesting – I've never been able to wrap my arms around or head around the fact that, you know, so many blue-collar workers are viewing Trump as sort of their guy. I would have thought traditionally that the Sanders position would have been much more you start to think about the Rust Belt workers and his
it's
support
true.
For workers. And I still can't get my arms around some of the Trump – base and why they support him.
It's true, but when you know, Bob, when you're thinking of something like free college tuition at a city university, a lot of those people are really ticked off because they think that poor kids, and we know this, poor kids get to go to college free or close to free, whereas a middle-class kid cannot go. And so Andrew Cuomo, being an astute politician, figured this out, came up with this Verschlugener program, which he said, you know, we're going to do that free college. It turns
Isn't
out,
it called Empire Scholarship?
Yeah.
Or like
Why
that?
Is it Verschlugener, if that is indeed the word, sir?
It's the word of the day. The reason it's Verschlugener is because it turns out it's not exactly what it was advertised as. In other words, you know, there are all kinds of caveats which make it very difficult for middle-class parents. And they didn't give that many out, and it didn't get taken by that many people. I wrote a column on it recently. You could look it up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You could look it up. The problem is that if you do look it up – well, the problem is since I wrote that column, we haven't seen Andrew Cuomo here.
Ah, I see. Anybody hear the Commonwealth Club yesterday?
No.
It was on right before I went on for Vox Pop, and Chris Christie was on. And they asked him right toward the end of the show, you know, if you were running the re-election campaign for Trump, who would you want to run against? And without, before even the question was fully asked, he said Elizabeth Warren. He said, bring her on.
Huh. Right. And you know that's what Trump wants, which is why he's saying things like Pocahontas about her and the rest of it, because he wants her. He thinks
tactically,
that's the ideal candidate.
That alone can't win a race. Why would Trump, or in this case Christie, say Elizabeth Warren?
Because intuitively these guys are saying, who's the best person for me to run against? Where do I have the greatest chance? And they think, for whatever their reasons, that it's Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, they're looking at, obviously, numbers, and obviously they're doing their own internal polling, and certainly they have that team of things. So I would say for them, they're probably looking at Elizabeth Warren, and maybe it's also based upon what the president thinks in his gut as well, who would be the best person to run against.
Interesting. Them. So in the intuition, then, of the Republicans, do they feel that the far left, which is, it looks like that's where the Democrats are headed, can't win a general?
you know, it's certainly possible. I think, you know, in that respect, they would look for somebody that they can label as, you know, who's not good for America. I mean, all the Republican talking points of obviously, you know, a socialist country, everything like that. And I think that's what they're looking to do. Who can they label for that? And, you know, they feel probably best that they can do that to Liz Warren.
Well, this was a fun conversation today.
It was
well, marginally so. Yeah. Communications consultant Joe Bonilla, thanks for being here, sir.
As always.
And keep those tweets coming. I find them entertaining.
Good tweet.
Dean of the College of Emergency and never drunk, right? That's
never,
one of your rules
never,
as a communications
never,
consultant.
Never.
Always tweet sober.
Never inebriated.
Right. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Robert Griffin. Very illuminating having you here today.
Terrific job.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Appreciate the ability to be here, and I will take the message of don't drink and tweet.
Yeah, good plan, sir. That should be Homeland Security, you know, that should be policy. VP of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, I've enjoyed how you are squelching Shar Talk at every turn now. This is great. This is a good turn of events.
He starches his shirts.
And Alan, thank you for being here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. There's a lot more roundtable ahead. We'll be right back.